is interested in the history of this project, my dear godbrother Gunagrahi Maharaj very lovingly took me under his wing when I was lost in the city, and he brought me to this piece of land and explained to me that he had a vision for a very opulent temple which would attract crowds of people. And he was explaining his vision. The temple will be here, and the parking will be here, and the traffic will be flowing in this pattern. Can you see it? I said, yes, Maharaj, I can see it. But in reality, all I could see is, this is Govardhan Hill. And all I could see was a place for two cows over there, and a garden over here, and a little homestead here, where simple devotees could gather and immerse their hearts in the purifying, uplifting vibration of Sri Krishna's holy name, and share in the gifts of nature, and learn the lessons imparted by the beauty and bounty of nature. I didn't have the heart to tell Gunagrahi Maharaj that that's what I was truly saying. I just said, yes, Maharaj, I'm seeing as you say, but I must confess that when I came back this time, I saw the manifestation of everything I saw in my mind's eye at that time.
Wow. Maharaj, can you speak a little louder, please?
My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, had a desire to print a book called The Light of the Bhagavat, which would be an illustrated book on the lessons imparted by nature. And when he had an invitation to attend an interfaith conference in Japan, this is long before he came to America, he made every endeavor to attend with a great anticipation that artists which would be available could paint the illustrations for The Light of the Bhagavat, which would be the lessons imparted by nature as based on the 10th canto descriptions of autumn, in which Shukadeva Goswami grants us entrance into the vision of an enlightened soul and his understanding of the natural order. That book did not come today until after Srila Prabhupada had left this world. And in that book, he stated what I always had complete faith in, that if you study nature, you don't need to go to school, which I'd already chosen long before. And how does a Krishna conscious person see the natural world? He sees Krishna's beauty. He feels Krishna's love. He hears Krishna's message in every aspect of creation. And this Krishna consciousness is divine. seeing the eyes through this perception, we discern the loving hand of the Lord directing and guiding our lives and teaching us through everything that our real home is with Him, and the lessons imparted in this world are ultimately meant to assist us on the path back home, back to Godhead. Krishna appeared in this world 5,000 years ago to demonstrate how man can live in harmony with nature, in harmony with the demigods, in harmony with the animals, if we simply keep Krishna in the center of all our talks, all our thoughts, all our activities. Because as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu explained, his philosophy, which Achintya Beda, Abheda Tattva, means everything and everyone in creation has something in common and something unique. The one thing we all share in common is we all come from God. When we say God is one, that's what we mean. In the unlimited living entities who expand from that one original source, God, there is unlimited variegatedness. Oneness is required for a central point of harmony. But it's the variety that is the source of pleasure. And why would the Lord create this cosmic manifestation if not at every point to be attracting our hearts back to His loving shelter? And that's why, after speaking Bhagavad Gita, he concludes with the immortal words, Sarva Dharma Pratyaja Mamekam Sharanam Bhaja Aham Tam Sarva Papyabhyo Moksayasham Masuja. Abandon all varieties of religion and surrender unto me, which is the essence of all religion. I will protect you from all sinful reactions incurred in your endeavors. I promise you this because you are my very dear friend. He's speaking to Arjuna, a warrior, on the battlefield, just before what was a world war erupted. But actually, surrender is not the last, in a sense it's the last word in Bhagavad Gita. But it's not surrender like we know it in this world, when you're confronted with a superior force. We call it surrender, and it is. But that's different than what Krishna is imploring in his message to Arjuna, which is meant for all the world. In the United States, which has the mightiest military in all the world and has a tendency to deal with every conflict as one would approach with a hammer every situation that looks like a nail. But the surrender Krishna refers to at the conclusion of Bhagavad Gita is that we experience in the face of a superior form of love, beauty, sweetness, and charm. It's not a surrender of fear and terror. in the face of a superior force which is about to subdue you. It's the surrender of love to the Supreme Person, whose heart is the source of infinite love, which we see reflected and expressed in every living entity, whose deepest need is for someone to love, something to do to express that love, and some hope to live for. But surrender unto me is not really the conclusion of Bhagavad Gita. It is the symptom of the conclusion of Bhagavad Gita, which is always think, Lord Krishna speaking to Arjuna and through him to the world, always think of me in love. Become my devotee. Surrender unto me. And thus you will come to me. I promise you this because you are my very dear friend. This was the conclusion of Krishna's encouragement to Arjuna just before the battle of Kurukshetra erupted into the massacre of 560 million warriors whose blood was flowing like rivers. After which, Arjuna and his brothers, who had fought valiantly against a military force vastly superior to their own, and won because Krishna was on their side, but were nevertheless overwhelmed with grief and guilt at the violence and suffering inflicted during the war and yet to follow by the widows who lost their husbands and the children who lost their fathers. And what did they have to do? Krishna himself was not able to console the Pandavas in the grief they experienced at the end of that battle. And he directed them to the general on the other side, who lay mortally wounded, filled with arrows, but due to his superior control of mind, was still in a coherent position to speak words of wisdom. So Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, unable to console his grieving servants, brought them to the general of the opposing army to hear his last words before he departed this world. And in the questions and answers, which completely relieved them of all grief and anguish, one question posed to Grandfather Bhishma by Maharaj Yudhisthira is, what is the ultimate religious principle? And Grandfather Bhishma replied, kindness.
Can you please repeat that? The question?
The question is, what is the ultimate religious principle? And Grandfather Bhishma's response was kindness, which is consistent with Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy and theology, because as Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur explained and Srila Prabhupada emulated, kindness towards all souls cannot be a different principle from love of God. And then Grandfather Bhishma told a story to highlight this principle. There was an ascetic, a tapasvi, who was pursuing this path of self-realization through severe penance. And he would stand in meditation, immobile, for months on end, meditating on the impersonal absolute. And he was very attentive to not inflict any pain or inconvenience to any living entity. So when he was meditating for months, standing in the shallow waters of a river, a pair of birds made a nest in his matted hair. And they laid eggs, which hatched. And he, because the birds thought it was a tree, because it didn't move. And he didn't want to disturb them, so he stood perfectly still. And he was attentive to when the birds were nudged out of the nest by the mother, and they learned to fly just enough to get back into the nest, and she would send them out every day. They'd fly a little bit further and then come back. And it was not until the baby birds departed in the morning and didn't come back all day and night, and then the parent birds left the nest, that he concluded they have left their home. And then he moved. He took a bath in the river after many months. And he was feeling very confident that this was a great sacrifice he just performed. When he heard a voice from the sky, his name is Judjali, "You are so arrogant, thinking you are so exalted in your achievement. Let me inform you, there is a simple merchant in Varanasi named Tuladhar who is vastly superior to you in enlightenment." He was enraged. He was so proud of his tapasya, his penance, that this voice from the sky said, "You're vastly inferior to a merchant." And enraged, he immediately began his journey to Varanasi to seek out this merchant Tuladhar, which he didn't have to do because he saw a merchant running down the road to him. "Judjali, Judjali, I am Tuladhar, eagerly awaiting your arrival." And he was shocked. "How does a simple merchant have more mystic ability than me?" And then he wanted to hear from him and get to know him. So in the questions and answers that ensued, came up the same principle that Grandfather Bhishma just answered Maharaj Yudhisthira. The highest religious principle is kindness, because it's the other dimension of love of God. And in describing different occupational duties, of which farming, agriculture, not modern day agribusiness, but traditional agriculture, working with the culture of the earth, which is one of harmony and goodness and sacrifice and living in the present with all the joys and lessons inherent to it. He said, even agriculture is abominable, because in the process of tilling the field, you are disturbing and harming and killing so many living entities that you cannot even see. Little microbes, even eating. And Judjali was astounded. How can you live without agriculture? And Tuladhar responded, if mankind would pursue this path of the ultimate religious principle to the extent that he would be so kind and considerate of all living entities, the earth would be so resilient, enlivened with affection for all her children, that she would produce everything man needed without having to be cultivated. Which we find in scriptures. During the reign of great saintly kings, the earth does not need to be tilled. She spontaneously produces grains and every edible for the welfare of her subjects. Now, this seems a little contradictory in the context of the world war that just raged, taking the life of 560 million men. And then, shortly after, this greatest enemy force of the world was relieved, which was the call of duty which brought Krishna to this world. He saw that there is one more great burden upon the face of this earth, and that is his own army, the Yadus, who, even though they were Lord Krishna's own dynasty, because they were such an insurmountable military force, Krishna understood that after he left this world, there would be nobody who could control them. And when they began to notice ill omens in Dwarka, Krishna told the Jadu dynasty that we can atone for whatever is causing these ill omens by distributing charity at Prabhas. And they prepared for a pilgrimage there. But Uddhava, who had been Krishna's very wise minister throughout his life, understood that there's something else unfolding here. Dwarka is the Lord's own abode. Ill omens manifest in Dwarka are not to be compensated by pious activity. And he confided in Krishna that, "I discern that you're about to bring your lila to a close." But nobody else detected. So the Jadus went to Prabhas. But under the influence of intoxicating wine, discord amongst them erupted into violence in which they all killed one another. And once again, 560 million lives were lost in the conflict that erupted. After which, Daruka, who is one of the very few survivors, having lost sight of his Lord, Sri Krishna, was climbing through the carnage and over broken chariots and dead horses and elephants, following only the scent of tulsi leaves, which led him to the lotus feet of his master, Sri Krishna. And as Daruka approached Krishna, a hunter named Jara, who was hiding in the bushes, mistook the beautiful soles of Krishna's feet to be the face of a deer and released an arrow which nicked the Lord's lotus foot. And then Jara saw that he had shot Lord Krishna. And he came before the Lord and bowed down and said, "Now all my sinful activities of a hunter have reached the climax where I shot my arrow and inflicted a wound upon your lotus foot. Please kill me immediately to relieve me of the violence I've been inflicting on so many living entities now culminating in you. And Krishna told him that you have been drawn into my lila, and now you have atoned for Lakshmi's curse upon you as Bhrigu Muni. You were cursed to become a hunter. Now, your role in this world is complete. And then Jara the hunter saw a celestial chariot descending from the heavens, which took him aboard and delivered him back home, back to Godhead. And he was simply speechless at the Lord's kindness. And Daruka emerged from the carnage and approached Lord Sri Krishna and told him that, like a dark night when the moon is no longer visible, I lost my vision, having lost sight of you. And Lord Krishna instructed him, go back to Dwarka and tell the remaining Jadus of the fate of their relatives, and that Balaram has already left, and my present condition. He told Daruka. And then as Krishna was speaking to Daruka, he heard celestial voices in the sky, and he saw all of Lord Krishna's weapons take personified forearm forms, and along with his horses and chariots, they all ascended into the sky. And he understood, what does this mean, that Krishna is alone, without his weapons, without his horses, his chariot? What's my function in this world, which was to harness Krishna's horses and hook them to his chariot and drive him to wherever he longed to go? And then Krishna told him, be peaceful and go. How could he be peaceful? And how could he leave the Lord to go back and tell his relatives that her whole dynasty has been annihilated by a conflict sparked amongst themselves under the influence of intoxicating wine? And as tears blinded his eyes, he was dragged by some invisible force, like a calf being pulled away from her mother. And he somehow crossed over the bay and over the walls and entered Dwarka, where he told the king, Ugrasena, and Krishna's own parents, Vasudeva and Devaki, and Balaram's mother, Rohini, that we've just lost our whole family, our whole dynasty, and Lord Balaram, and Lord Krishna is about to depart this world. And they hurried to the scene of the massacre, and the wives were looking for their husbands, and the children were looking for their fathers. Vasudeva and Devaki were looking for their child Krishna. Rohini was looking for her child Balaram. And they all just entered into the funeral pyres which raged across that field. And Arjuna, who had been wandering around Dwarka like a haunted orphan, just wanting at every turn to give up his life, but Daruka consoled him and reminded him that you yet have a mission in this world. Lord Krishna requested me to tell you to escort the remainder of the Jadus living within Dwarka to Indraprastha. So he crossed them over the bay, and as they assembled on the mainland, tremors began to shake the earth. The sky was overcast with ominous clouds. Lightning streaked crisscross paths across the sky, and thunder rumbled. And as the surviving Jatus turned back to their home, Dwarka, they saw the entire island city slip down beneath the ocean. And as the boiling waves of the ocean covered over Lord Krishna's own abode and their own home, their screams and cries just merged with the lightning, and their tears merged with the rain. And Arjuna had to guide them on the last caravan from Dwarka to Indraprastha. And on the way, the caravan, led by the mighty Arjuna, who was never defeated in heaven or on earth, whose prowess was universal, was arrested by what Srila Prabhupada calls a group of infidel cowherd men. They blocked the path. Arjuna reached for his mighty Gandiva bow, but he found that he couldn't string it. He called for his other weapons, but the first time they never came. He remembered the celestial weapons, but he forgot the incantations. And he was beginning to experience that when Krishna left, he took truth, victory, power, morality, and religion with him. And Arjuna, who was primarily responsible for winning the Kurukshetra War, had become so paralyzed with impotence that that band of infidel cowherd men stole away the queens of Lord Krishna, who Arjuna was entrusted to protect on the caravan to shelter Indraprastha. And as the queens were screaming for Arjuna's assistance, and those cowherds were taunting him with ridicule and jest, Arjuna experienced and taught us how to respond with a time factor which gradually strips everyone of all trace of material dignity. Arjuna returned to his brothers, and the news of his humiliation spread worldwide, and the Pandavas understood it's time for us to begin the final journey. And following the path of their forefathers, they ascended into the Himalayas. They headed north. And as they climbed higher and higher to that elevation where the air is thin and scanty clouds cover sparse vegetation, beyond the point of no return, where there's no sustenance for human life at such high elevations, Arjuna began to reflect. How was it that he was empowered to cross that field of the mighty Kuru dynasty and defeat them? It was Krishna's own words. Always remember me, become my devotee, worship me, offer your homage unto me, and thus you will come to me. I promise you this because you are my beloved friend. Reflecting upon those words, which are resonating like the sweetest song within his heart, Arjun became enlivened and inspired. And all the traumas and all the ordeals and pain and separation, he began to see as pieces of a puzzle coming together into the most beautiful, meaningful conclusion of life. And as those five brothers, the Pandavas, tread their last footsteps into the peaks of the Himalayas, they saw that those craggy mountain peaks transformed into golden ornate domes, and that rocky, rugged path became a smooth walkway made of marble inlaid with gems. And when Arjuna looked before him, he saw within the window of one of those palaces his dear friend Lord Krishna, smiling with such affection. "Remember, I told you, you will come to me. I promise you this because you are my very dear friend." And just in that instant, before his eyes were flooded with tears and his heart was immersed in emotion, and he fell into the arms of Lord Krishna once again, he reflected upon those words. And Krishna's promises are always fulfilled. Whatever tears we shed for him, he sheds 100 for us. He makes all arrangements. And being grateful in all things has a subtle difference in being grateful for all things. If you see someone is injured, someone you love is ill, they're facing a questionable diagnosis, are we grateful for that? Not necessarily. We're not asked to be. Grateful in such a situation has a subtle distinction from being grateful for it. Grateful in it means we discern how Krishna is preparing us and teaching us our final lessons so we can graduate from the school of life and return home back to Godhead, where life is eternal, full of knowledge and bliss. Thank you very much for bringing this vision into reality, that the concept of acquiring this land for a grand temple and a huge parking lot and masses of sophisticated people coming together became the opportunity for a very modest farm initiative where we can experience true wealth, which is land, cows, grains, the gifts and the beauty and bounty of nature, which teaches us about Krishna's nature, which is very kind, loving, and purifying. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments?
I have a small question and a comment. Yes? As a prologue to the Vishnu Sahasranam, the Bhishma Yudhishthira Samvad, part of it, I asked this specific question because you said there was a question about the Dharma. And in this particular conversation, Yudhishthira asks Bhishma, it's in Sanskrit, so I'll just repeat that. He says, Ko dharma sarva dharmanam bhavataha paramo mataha. He's asking, what is the ultimate dharma according to your opinion. And then the Bhishma response to that is Jagat Prabhu Deva Deva Manantam Purushottamam. The ultimate dharma is the only prayers to Vishnu. Obviously, I'm not disagreeing that you mentioned that it is the kindness. Is that
no, I said kindness to all living entities is the inseparable counterpart of love and devotion for Krishna.
That is absolutely true, but in that context, in the discussion between Bhishma and Yudhishthira, it did not come up as kindness. He is only saying pray to Vishnu, and that's the only thing that you have to do. Of course, kindness...
I'm saying prayers to Vishnu means devotion to Krishna.
Yes.
And devotion to Krishna cannot be
separated
from compassion and kindness towards all his parts and parcels.
No, I didn't mean that way. It's Krishna and Vishnu are the same to me.
Yes.
It's the same. But I also agree with you as kindness to all souls is the ultimate path to...
It's not my opinion. It's just words
it's,
of Bhishma
Dev. It's not my opinion. I agree with you, but somewhere... But it was, my only small concern was that it was not documented in the Bhishma Yudhishthira Samvada as I understand it. That's out of curiosity, I just asked the question. Just out of curiosity.
Thank you for filling us in.
Uh-huh.
Anything else?
What are the symptoms of surrender? How?
Humility, dedication to the self, assurance that Krishna will surely protect us, accepting the Lord as one's only maintainer, embracing all things favorable for devotional service, and rejecting all things unfavorable. The youthful son of Nanda Maharaj hears the prayers of one who approaches him with the spirit of Sharanagati, surrender. Now what is humility? It's a very deep topic with which you can use many words. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur summarized it into not expecting anything for yourself. It can also be translated as service attitude. It can also be translated as just emptying yourself of all false ego. Leaving you with nothing but devotional service. Yes.
It might be pretty obvious, but is in the story the reason the merchant was more advanced than the person that Maitreya, is it because of his kindness? Is that why he was more advanced? I never got why he was more advanced.
Yes, that's why he's advanced. Why the unembodied voice from the sky sent this great sage to a simple merchant was to help complete his experience of humility. Because a merchant is not expected to be advanced in spiritual knowledge. A sage is. But because the sage was infected with pride because of his tapasya, and the merchant was enlightened because of his humility, it was an arrangement to fully deflate the pride of the sage by encountering such an emblem of humility. Anything else? Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Hi.
think that would be good so we could, can we ask a question? Is there anything that needs to be offered?
Bedrolls.
Okay, thank you. That might be good, like, for people.